Welcome to Access Utah. The most famous person with autism, Temple Grandin, has a new book out called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. It is currently number 21 on the bestseller list. Today on the program, producer Sherry Quinn presents this two-part program on autism. In the first half, Temple Grandin talks about the book, her latest research in the livestock industry, and what she thinks parents, clinicians, and educators should be doing to improve the lives of children with autism. In the second half of the show, we hear from Utah State University artist and recipient of the 2013 Utah Visual Arts Fellowship, Christopher Gauthier, about his photo art exhibit called Evidence and Artifacts, produced by Elaine Taylor. This will be coming up after the news.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Open Monday through Saturday until 2 with a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
I'm really glad the AMI is producing this video so you can see how a big plant works when everything is operating correctly. I have worked all my career on improving how animals are handled. And one of my biggest frustrations is you go out there on the internet and there's all these terrible undercover videos and there's not much video of things being done right. Now, one of the problems
Welcome
with having
to
a lot
Access
of
Utah. This is Sherry
is
Quinn.
This is safety issues,
Temple
safety
Grandin
issues,
thinks
also,
in pictures. She is professor of animal science at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. She used her notoriety to dispel the negative labels of autism that plagued her as a child and a young woman.
One of the things that really motivated me is I wanted to prove to the world I wasn't stupid.
I first met Ms. Grandin at her home in 2011 and interviewed her about her career and her moral beliefs that set her apart from other scientists and big names. Here is a clip from that profile piece. I am literally on the edge of my seat, on Temple Grandin's brown cowhide couch next to her. There are stacks of papers, books, and science and business journals scattered everywhere in her living room. In her modest two-story condo near the University of Colorado in Fort Collins, the walls are collaged with paintings and photographs of cattle, horses, and Western art, and tables are piled high with animal sculptures, stuffed animals, and knickknacks. All gifts from her family, friends, and adoring fans from across the world.
I've been kind of following a lot of this stuff, science and nature. We're sitting here doing this interview, and I got so many science and natures on the couch that there's no place to sit.
Grandin is a prolific writer and has written numerous popular books about animal behavior. She has published over 100 scientific and technical articles on livestock handling. Early on in her career, it was her mission to make slaughterhouses more humane. And she has become a world leader in the design of livestock handling facilities. Her curved chute system is used worldwide, and her writings on the principles of grazing animal behavior have helped many livestock producers reduce stress in cows and pigs during handling. Grandin's philosophy, "The world is cruel, but we don't have to be," has caught on, and even fast food corporations such as McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King have begun to implement her animal welfare guidelines at their slaughterhouses. Her close friend Rosalie Winard recalls the first time she visited a slaughterhouse with Grandin.
I was there to photograph, and I was allowed to photograph outside the actual slaughter itself because they never allow that. And after we toured the whole plant and the stairway to heaven, Temple asked if I wanted to go in to see the actual slaughter, because this is something that she's very, very proud of, because she really has created a painless slaughter for the animals. And we went inside, and there were two other women who were from the biosphere, and we witnessed it, and it was quick and painless. And then we went outside back on the ramp, and much to my amazement and very touching, we got out on the ramp and she said, "Could we have a minute of silence for the cows now?" And it was just this unexpected, beautiful, touching moment. And it is how Temple relates to the cows and all the animals she works with.
Grandin is currently traveling the country promoting her new book, The Autistic Brain, co-authored by Richard Panek. It is currently on the New York Review of Books bestseller list. I talked to her on the phone about the book right before she left for an autism meeting in Australia. She first said the main difference between the autistic brain and the non-autistic brain is that the circuits involved with social relationships are abnormal.
Like face recognition, recognizing emotional expressions, those sorts of things. In the people that are fully verbal, that's one abnormality that seems to go across the spectrum. Now you get into other things like sensory problems, visual thinking, mathematical thinking, word thinking. Those things are highly, highly variable. But when you look at individuals on the autistic spectrum that are fully verbal, they tend to have uneven skills. They tend to be good at one thing and really bad at something else. And that's one of the things I talk about in the autistic brain.
The right side of Grandin's brain dominates. When she was 63, her brain was scanned and analyzed by a team of neuroimaging experts, including researchers from the University of Utah. One of the results revealed an abnormally large amygdala, a deep region of the brain that processes emotion.
Then you start looking at things like I've got asymmetry in the fluid-filled ventricles. Well, that kind of wrecked my math department. And then I've got my language circuit morphed into a huge visual circuit that most other people don't have. You see, what's happening is the new technologies are coming in for scanning that were developed for the Defense Department for head injuries in veterans. It's sort of like getting the Hubble Space Telescope, but nobody really knows how to use it yet. And some of those images that are in the autistic brain are sort of like, you know, the first little looks with the new technology. And what needs to be done is looking at different types of autism and then seeing how these circuits are different. You know, the circuit in my brain for speak what you see had less bandwidth, and that may explain why I had problems with getting my speech out, getting my words out. I had difficulty with that.
Grandin, once terrified of public speaking, looks like a natural on stage. She overcame her fear with practice.
Practice, 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 because when I was in graduate school, my very first talk, I panicked and I walked out. It's just practice, practice, just doing it. And then I'd read my evaluations carefully, and I remember one time a student wrote on one of my evaluations, I always gave the same lecture, because even though I didn't always give the same lecture, I tended to start all my cattle lectures with the same slide on cattle vision. Well, I got rid of that slide, and then I started mixing my slides around in different order, and that got rid of that problem.
Can you discuss why there are so many forms of autism on the spectrum?
Well, the problem is diagnosis is a behavioral profile. It is not precise, like going out and doing a lab test for tuberculosis. It's not a precise diagnosis. In fact, over the decades, the American Psychiatric Association has kept changing the diagnosis, and in the autistic brain, I have an entire chapter just on how the diagnosis has changed. You see, it's a behavioral profile consisting of a cluster of symptoms. And it's very important that parents and teachers not get hung up on these diagnostic labels. You know, if your kid's labeled dyslexia, ADHD, you know, oppositional defiant, conduct disorder, you know, any one of these DSM labels, don't get hung up on it. They are not precise.
Autism diagnoses are on the rise. About 1 in 88 children has been diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. And Utah has the highest rate in the country, according to estimates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Grandin said some of the rise is attributable to increased detection back in 1980, because in order to be diagnosed with it, you had to have speech delay.
In other words, you had to have speech delay before 30 months of age. Then in the early 90s, they added Asperger's, which is basically the social awkwardness, you know, and there's no speech delay. So that's going to broaden it right there a whole lot. And then the new DSM is taking out the Asperger's, and they're going to rename that social communication disorder, and because I think this has to do with politics and, you know, making services.
Grandin added there are some upset about the new classifications among some individuals with Asperger's.
Half of Silicon Valley's got some Asperger's, but most of them are undiagnosed. The ones that are diagnosed kind of, you know, feel a camaraderie, and there's a lot of concern about, you know, loss of services. See, part of the reason for using all these labels is you have to have them to get services. Like if your child needs to get special ed in school, you've got to have a label. If you don't have a label, you're not going to get any services.
What is the most exciting research these days?
The research I think they need to do, that absolutely needs to be done. They've done a lot of research on the social circuits. We know how those don't work. And there's old fMRI technology that could actually diagnose that that's not even being used. But what needs to be worked on are the sensory problems, because you have some people that can't stand fluorescent lights, and they're not all diagnosed autistic either. Some of them are diagnosed sensory processing problem, Some are diagnosed with dyslexia. Some are just diagnosed with learning problems. And there's some individuals can't tolerate the flicker of fluorescent lights. It drives them absolutely crazy. Others can't tolerate loud noises. I was at a meeting just yesterday. There was a little boy that had on those kind of headphones they wear out at the airport, you know, to protect from the jet blast, because he just couldn't stand normal noise. And we need to find treatments for these sensory issues. But they're very, very variable. One kid may be bothered by smoke alarm or, you know, loud noises like that. Other kid doesn't bother them.
There is no single cause of autism. Several culprits are suspected. It is clear genetics influence the risk for developing autism. However, genetics does not account for all cases. Toxins in our environment, like prenatal exposure to the chemicals thalidomide and valproic acid, has been linked to increased risk of autism. And new studies are providing evidence that in some cases, the development of autism stems from epigenetic sources. Problems in the control of gene expression in brain cells, for example.
There's also some research showing that low folic acid, and taking folic acid, you know, right around, you know, conception, can help reduce autism and other neurological problems. You know, we're got a diet in this country that's deficient in omega-3s, and it could be a number of things. So genetics is complicated. There's lots of little tiny code variations that fall in the genetics.
Do you think there could be an evolutionary advantage to autism?
Mild forms, there's some advantages. I mean, who do you think made the first stone spear? It wasn't the yak-yaks around the campfire, that's for sure. You see, a little bit of these traits gives some advantage. You wouldn't want to totally get rid of these traits. The people with, that are to take out some social circuits, then you seem to have more circuits for, like, figuring out stuff, like programming computers and doing art and things like that. And so a little bit of the trait gives some advantages.
What are some technologies that you think help autistics?
One thing I'm seeing too many kids doing is getting totally addicted to video games. They're not doing anything else. They're not working for the video game industry or learning programming. And any cognitive advantages you can get from video games, you're going to get 30 minutes to 1 hour a day, and that's what the research shows. You know, I'm very concerned that there's too many smart, geeky kids out there that are not getting their abilities developed. I mean, when I was a young child, my ability in art was really, really encouraged. But I'm seeing too many cases where I see a smart kid that needs to be doing advanced math when he's in the third grade, and they won't let him do it. And that's just absolutely terrible. And then the kid gets bored and turns into a behavior problem. See, one of the problems you have is autism is such a big spectrum. You know, teachers have a hard time shifting gears from the half of the population that remains nonverbal and very severely handicapped to a kid that's just socially awkward and maybe brilliant in math but may need special ed in reading, or one like me that's hopeless in algebra but really good with art type of stuff and industrial design types of things. Another big concern I've got is, especially with some of these milder autistic kids, they need to learn work skills. You know, like how to just get out there every day and do a job. And if there were paper routes still around, I'd put them on a paper route. You know, or they could walk dogs for people. My mother arranged a little sewing job for me that I did 2 afternoons a week.
Grandin was raised with a strong work ethic that helped her get through the onslaught of criticisms from her peers and adults for simply being herself.
When I was a young kid, I was labeled as mentally retarded, too. One of the things that really motivated me is I wanted to prove to the world I wasn't stupid. And I can remember when I got some of my really nice drawings done, I looked at these drawings and I go, well, I can't be too stupid and then draw this and then see the project get built and have it work.
That determination continues in her livestock work today. Next, Grandin discusses her latest agricultural research.
We've been working on a lot of different things. My student just worked on a project where we went out to a feed yard and watched cattle going through the squeeze chute, and sometimes you miscatch, you make a mistake, and catch the animal's head wrong in the squeeze chute, and you're working them, and that definitely, you know, was causing some discomfort to the cattle. I mean, that's something you just would know, and I want to make it very clear, we did not deliberately miscatch any cattle. We just watched, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cattle go through a squeeze chute, and then sometimes they make a mistake and miscatch one of them, and we found if he did that, they would tend to moo more. I've done research where I developed vocalization scoring for use in slaughterhouses. And if you want to pass the McDonald's audit, you're only allowed to have 3 cattle out of 100 mooing when you're handling them. And if you got more than 3 out of 100 mooing, then you've got problems. You know, and the mooing is associated with something aversive. And if you make a mistake when you're working the cattle, instead of catching them around the neck with the head gate, maybe get them across the jaw with it, you know, they're going to move more. And my student just worked on quantifying that. And I went to a very good feed yard, and every once in a while they would happen to make a mistake. We recorded how the cattle behaved in that situation as compared to one was done absolutely right. And what it showed is you want to do it absolutely right as much as possible.
She said one of the biggest changes in the industry is in maintenance and management.
You know, a lot of slaughterhouses, you don't have to build a lot of new stuff to fix them. You got to fix a lot of simple things like non-slip floor in the stun box, get rid of reflections. Animals are afraid of a lot of little distractions that we tend to not see, like reflections on shiny metal, stuff like that, sunbeams, seeing people walk by. And if you get rid of the distractions, they'll walk right in. And then you also have got to have management that cares about doing things right. And I worked with McDonald's and other companies on implementing their animal welfare auditing. And then another program I worked on was video auditing, where video cameras are used, where people over the Internet look in and see what's going on. Boy, 20 years ago, they were really awful. And things have improved a lot. You might want to look at my beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin. And I also have pork plant video tour with Temple Grandin. And you can see exactly how the things work when they're working
cattle
right.
Cattle are offloaded as calmly as possible to minimize excitement and prevent slips and falls. If an animal falls down, it can get bruised, it can get injured. Non-slip flooring is essential to prevent slips and falls.
How many slaughterhouses are taking on these new practices?
Ironically, most of the big plants are doing it. So there was a while where the big plants actually were better. Now the small plants that are audited by, you know, companies like Whole Foods and things like that, they're doing a much better job. And there was a lot of problems where people just didn't know. The other thing is you got to have management that cares about doing things right. And if you don't have management that cares about doing things right, you're going to have bad stuff going on. And one of the things we learned is there were some managers that actually had to be removed. There were some people that had to be removed. And in the big corporations, that's actually easier to do than in some of the smaller places.
To understand the animals and learn what works best for them, Grandin spends time with them in the field.
You just sit down on the ground, they'll just come up to you. See, the thing is, new things are both frightening and attractive. They're frightening if you take them and just shove them in the animal's face. But if you just sit still and let the animal approach something new, both horses and cattle will come up to strange things. Like if you put a, you know, just park a car out in the middle of the pasture, all the animals will come up to it.
Animal behavior and the biology of their memory is mystifying. Just think of butterflies. Grandin is credited for providing insight to these mysteries. She says animals are very specific in how they remember things.
And in my book, Animals in Translation, I talk about, you know, visual fear memories. You know, as a horse in Animals in Translation, he's terrified of black cowboy hats. White hats are fine, but black cowboy hats are bad. Because when an idiot threw alcohol in his eyes, he was looking right at a black hat. And then Betsy, my agent's got a little dog that's terrified of baseball hats. And if you got a baseball hat on, the dog's terrified of it. You see, because something bad happens to that dog when someone was wearing a baseball hat. And that's what the dog was looking at when the bad thing happened. So they tend to get very sensory-specific fear memories, you know, where a certain sound or a certain visual image is associated with something bad.
To some, Grandin is considered a savant and a voice of reason. She offers thoughtful perspectives on an assortment of major issues, from politics and business to technology and education. Innovation in engineering gets her really excited. And she says getting children with autism interested in specialized projects can be a key to their success.
Well, I think 3D printing is really super exciting. And that's a great thing to get kids that are technically inclined involved with, have them draw stuff and then make it on 3D printers. And they're coming down in price, where you can actually get a 3D printer kit now for about $700. And, you know, we need to be getting a lot of these kids that are kind of different into things like maker community groups and hackerspace, where they get to do cool stuff with things like 3D printers. Because the only places where I was not teased was when I was doing specialized interests, like horseback riding and electronics. And we need to be, you know, these kids that are kind of different, I don't care what their label is, we need to get them involved with things where they can excel and where they have shared interests with their peers. I mean, it could be the school play, the school newspaper, band, music, art, computer programming. It could be a lot of different things. You know, you got to dream. You know, when we were all kids, we worshiped the astronauts. You know, back when I was, you know, when I was a child, you know, the astronauts were our heroes because they were doing, you know, exciting exploration.
She says schools are not doing enough to foster children's specialized talents. And an example in Utah sticks out.
I've heard really stupid things. When I was in Utah, I heard something really dumb where there was a really smart boy who was brilliant in math, and he was one credit off and couldn't get an advanced placement because he had to take a special ed course in reading. And to not let him take advanced placement science and math is just bureaucratic stupidity. And that happened last year in Utah.
Helping others and seeing real results are major motivating factors for Grandin to work so hard.
Kids come up to me telling me that I've really motivated them to succeed. You know, I have a parent tell me the kid went to college because of my book, or a rancher tells me the corral system worked well. That's the sort of things that motivate me. We got to make real positive change happen in the world. You know, and also I'm not abstract. What can we do to do sensible, real stuff that's going to work? And I'm seeing too many smart kids that are kind of quirky and different, and they get labeled, and they sort of almost become their handicap. I mean, autism is an important part of who I am, but it's secondary to a lot of my other work. And I think it's difficult lots of times for teachers to shift gears between a smart science nerd, and I'm seeing them getting held back and not allowed to do the advanced math they should be doing. And then you've got another population that's much more handicapped and nonverbal, and they're all called autism. See, they're all called the same thing. You know, people being language-based sort of get locked into this, and I just see the kid. Parents say, well, what's the most important thing you can do for autism? Well, if he's three and he's not talking, it's tons and tons of early intervention, one-to-one teaching. That's the same for everybody. But let's say you've got a 10-year-old getting bullied in school. You know, I ask, well, what's he good at doing? You know, is he just working at grade level and everything? Is he really excel in one subject? You know, I got to ask a lot of questions to find out stuff about him. People tend to oversimplify and we'll put all the autism in one basket. Well, that just doesn't work. You know, once they get past the age of two or three or four, it just doesn't work. And I was just at a meeting last night, and it was a smart little third grader, and they're making him do baby math over and over and over again. And I said, that is just wrong. Get the fourth-grade math book and let them do it. Get them the fifth-grade math book. Math's a subject where you just let them go ahead. Now, I wouldn't recommend that for literature. But math's a subject where you can just let them go ahead. He wants to do college math on a laptop in the third-grade classroom. Fine. Let him do it. You know, too many of these kids, they aren't learning basic skills like shopping. How do you walk up to somebody at McDonald's and order a hamburger? Work skills. They aren't learning those things. And then my science teacher was a very important mentor in high school because I didn't do much studying when I was in high school. I learned a lot of work skills, but he got me interested in science. And, you know, we need to be – there's a lot of retirees around that are probably bored, and maybe they could introduce a kid to auto mechanics or art or even programming. And it doesn't matter if it's ancient history, because what you're doing is you're turning the spark on. You're getting the spark turned on. Getting the kid motivated. But if the kids aren't exposed to these things, they're not going to get interested in 3D printers if they don't know about them. The kids have got to find out that this stuff even exists.
Exposure and hands-on experience can make the difference, according to Grandin.
The government's gotten too abstract. I'm a bipartisan trasher of this. You're getting everything become an abstraction. And I think a lot of this gets back to taking out the hands-on classes. You got people making policy. They get through college, they get a degree in poli-sci, then they go internship for a congressman, then they work in D.C., and they've never been out in the field finding out what happens out in the field with whatever thing they're politicking about. We've got to get back to doing what I call real stuff.
Grandin is considered a leading voice in animal behavior and the humane slaughter of livestock. Her dedication to the science of autism and our societal views of it have changed and influenced many lives. She's always on the move across the country, giving talks, signing books, doing research, writing articles and books, mentoring colleagues, parents, youth, and students. She's busy. It seems one of the only times she gets to relax is when she is flying on an airplane, like one of her many heroes, the astronauts. She can sit back and watch.
I get to see quite a few movies on airplanes. When I can't sleep on a plane, I'll sometimes watch three movies. Well, I just saw the new Star Trek movie, and of course I always relate to Mr. Spock because he's very logical. Very, very good to talk to you.
Coming next, we hear from producer Elaine Taylor about a photo art exhibit called The Faces of Autism.
The Be Well Moment is made possible by the USU Department of Human Resources Wellness Program at usu.edu/HR.
Sticking to a regular exercise schedule isn't easy. After all, there are plenty of potential hindrances: time, boredom, injuries, and self-confidence. But these issues don't need to stand in your way. Consider practical strategies for overcoming common barriers to fitness. Squeeze in short walks throughout the day. If you don't have time for a full workout, don't sweat it. Shorter spurts of exercise, such as 10 minutes of walking spaced throughout the day, offer benefits too. Choose activities you enjoy. You'll be more likely to stay interested. Remember, anything that gets you moving counts. Exercise with friends, relatives, neighbors, or coworkers. You'll enjoy the camaraderie and the encouragement of the group. Schedule exercise as you would schedule an important appointment. Block off times for physical activity and make sure your friends and family are aware of your commitment. Whatever you decide to do, stick with it and remember why you're doing it. Your heart will thank you. This is Dana for the Be Well program at Utah State University. Be well, Utah. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Elaine Taylor. Welcome to Science Questions.
My name is Christopher Gauthier. I am an assistant professor of photography here at Utah State University.
Christopher Gauthier's recent work has focused on the interaction between humans and the environment. Gauthier is currently working on a project titled Evidence and Artifacts, Facing Autism, in which he takes portraits of people with autism as well as their support groups, including family and doctors. Gauthier's work has been featured at Johns Hopkins University and the White House. He met with us to discuss his art as well as his work as an advocate for those with autism. Maybe you could take us back to the beginning of this story, how you first became involved in autism.
That's an interesting journey. It goes actually much further back than actually the point at which I had children. My wife and I were living in Jackson, Mississippi, and we had just survived the worst natural disaster we had ever experienced in our lives, which was Hurricane Katrina. And you know, you get through a hurricane, you have no running water, you have no electricity, school was shut down, you know, and we had nowhere to go. And so, you know, obviously one thing led to another, and 9 months later my daughter was born. And so she was our little hurricane gift. She was the most remarkable little creature to see born. It was just really terrifying for me. Totally not thinking I was ready to have kids, but she was incredible. And she came out literally kicking and screaming. Not the classic, you know, doctor pulls them out and they spank them. No, no. She was furiously yelling at the universe. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's my girl. She's going to take on the world. But I didn't realize that what that represented was something bigger. And it didn't start to manifest immediately right away, but pretty quickly, that Maddie had tons and tons and tons of sensory issues. She was not a typical child. And the challenge we had was the pediatricians never believed us. We heard the message that many parents in the autism community hear, which is, you know, you go to the doctor and you explain to them about your really terrifying concern, and they placate you and they say, well, that's normal. Well, the kind of diarrhea my daughter had that was constant all the time, so much so that her poor little bottom was burned, is not normal. For her to basically scream almost all the time is not normal. You know, she was so neurologically amped up that she was trying to stand within weeks of birth. She was already trying to pull herself up out of her crib. Before she was two, she had already climbed out of her bed. You know, we had to take the gates down. We had to take all sensory materials out of the room just so she could sleep. And so there was a huge frustration, you know, connected to relation with the medical field and the experience we were having with my daughter. Same problem with my son, who was born 14 months later. His manifestations were much different. And he developed pretty neurotypically along the way until just pre 1.5. But he was very, very quiet. He was really different than Maddie. But what he did was he started to develop what are called perseverance behaviors. And so he would play with his eyelashes, or he would pick up a car and spin the wheels over and over again. He'd gravitate towards doors and open and close them repeatedly over and over again. And trying to get his attention by auditory means was almost impossible. I mean, you would literally have to go up, pick him up, turn him around, make him look at you to get recognition at a certain point. And there was about a year and a half phase, there was a huge regression in language. He had language very early. He had very complex language very early. In fact, one of his first words was not mom or dad, but it was office, which was kind of funny. And, you know, again, now I'm starting to look back and think, wow, okay, that may have been a telltale of something really interesting. But he lost that. And it took us a significant amount of time and a significant amount of work to bring him back to us.
Gothier and his wife tried desperately to understand what was happening to their children. They found that controlling aspects of their home environment could give their children some peace in a world that, to them, was full of uncomfortable sensory stimulation.
We changed our children's diet. We went gluten-free, casein-free, and soy-free. We tried to eradicate as many GMOs as possible. We have taken as much plastic out of their lives as we possibly can. You know, food storage devices are almost exclusively glass in our house, you know, at this point, because of all the ways in which we have found that the environmental insults in autism are a huge part of the stories we keep hearing from many parents and many researchers. And it's a hard road.
Could you maybe give me a definition of what autism is, or the spectrum of autism? I know it's broad.
Yeah, and for me to answer that is hard because I'm not a doctor. I'm an advocate. I'm a parent. And autism is, the clinical definition of it is a social-emotional delay. So it's somebody who has significant challenges relating to the larger social community. And that's a really loose definition. But I have found that it's kind of not that way in many cases. The Asperger's community is really unique. Yes, they're on the spectrum. Yes, they have challenges, but they're hyper aware. In some cases, they're hyper social. There's research by Tony Atwood, who's an Australian doctor, who looks at young girls and the ways in which young girls slip through the diagnostic method, because that model is designed for boys, the way boys manifest. Girls can slip through these social cracks very well. My daughter's spectacular at getting through social situations. She clearly has Asperger's. There's no getting around that. So if you measure her based on the models for boys, yes, she seems great. You know, she seems sweet. She seems terribly social. But if you start looking at the way she interacts on a much more personal level, it's very difficult. And if you look at her, what she does when she interacts, she's scripting. She has a system of how she knows how to engage to be successful, where my son, on the opposite side of things, hasn't got a clue on how to interact with other people.
Maybe going back to your story of your kids, how did you finally get them diagnosed?
We didn't get anything that we needed until we came here to Utah. And we took our kids to the Center for Persons with Disabilities, to their Up to 3 program. And they were spectacular for us. Their introduction to some of the therapy models was extremely helpful. Their support network was extremely helpful. The opportunity we had by meeting other parents in the community was absolutely phenomenal. In fact, I think it's the catalyzing impetus of why I started this project of Facing Autism, is we got enough support that we felt like we were out from underneath the rock, and we had to give back to the community at large.
Utah has some pretty startling statistics when it comes to autism. Garthier explains the usefulness, as well as the flaws, of some of the research that shows how common autism may be in the U.S.
The numbers are really interesting and kind of terrifying as the national average. Okay, Utah is 1 in 47, and that's out of that same measuring model. You know, when you think about the number of 1 in 47... That's an epidemic proportion. 1 in 47, really, that's a very hard number to kind of abstractly think about. Who is that? What is that? You know, how many individuals does that represent? And I think it's important to recognize we're not talking about one. We're talking about thousands, okay, or hundreds of thousands. Well, what that actually represents in the state of Utah is 19,700 and some odd individuals. To get more specific, that represents 8-year-olds in the public school systems receiving services. It does not represent those who are not diagnosed, those who are not receiving services, and it doesn't represent any of the individuals who are homeschooled, which is actually a fairly large part of this community, or those in private schools. So it's a really small number of 8-year-olds that 1 in 47 represents. Now, when I say small, we're talking almost 20,000 individuals in the state of Utah. That's not small. But when you start to think about all those who don't fit into that, kids who are older, kids who are younger, and those who aren't receiving services, it's a disproportionate number. And so 1 in 47 actually is not accurate. It is much worse.
You came to Utah with your kids, and you've started to become an advocate. What led you to this art project? Could you introduce this project and kind of describe it to me?
Yeah, Evidence and Artifacts is a collection of work that I do that's based on... it started actually as environmental impact issues, air quality issues here in Cache Valley, because we have literally the worst air in the world, even though it's for a very short period of time. The toxicity levels that we deal with on an annual basis rival places like San Paulo or LA or Reno. And as that went along, I started to look at the individuals who were in the environment who were affected. And it was a clear dovetail to my own life experience with my children. And why are these kids, you know, manifesting autism? What is causing this? Now, like I said before, I'm an artist. You know, I'm not a scientist. But I had a sneaking suspicion that the environmental assault that we're getting isn't helping, you know, this very vulnerable population. And then it just sort of grew beyond that. It went from spaces to those individuals who are living in those environmental spaces. And so Evidence and Artifacts Facing Autism grew out of that concern of that representation. Again, we'll come back to that number that you asked me about, the statistics. If you tell an individual, and you know, somebody you walk down the street or a politician, 1 in 88 or 1 in 47, what they hear is 1. It's like, you know, you're going to go buy something for $9.99. They hear $9. It's the same problem, but they don't think about the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. And being a visual artist, I know what visual representation is like. And so this project is envisioned to be in a major museum so that when you walk into the gallery space, from floor to ceiling, across every wall, are thousands of faces looking at you. You cannot escape. A community who can't, in reality, look you in the eye. They're looking at you, and you cannot avoid your own humanity.
Did you start off taking portraits of your own children, or how did you initiate this?
The first portrait was actually of my daughter. It's right in front of you right now. And it's an interesting story, and it's actually a kind of an embarrassing story. Maddie and I were in the middle of a huge conflict, and she is my African honey badger. She's this tiny little fluffy cute creature that is so amped up and kind of nutty, she would take on a pack of lions on her own. And so, you know, she never backs down from a fight with me. And I was so frustrated, and I was yelling, and she was yelling, and I realized I wasn't being the parent I wanted to be. And that's an awful conundrum to be in. And I realized also that I'm an artist. I can do art about whatever I want. I can do art about my own life struggle. And so I walked down, grabbed my camera and my lighting gear, and set it up in the kitchen, and picked Maddie up and plopped her in a booster seat. And she's still barking at me. And I looked over the top of the camera and I said, "Madeline Elise." And she shot me the look that's in this picture. And that's her defiance. And then I, with great humility, turned the camera on myself. And I made the portrait of myself. And if you look close enough, you can see that I'm trying to control the anger that I have from the moment. And it took me 9 months of having made that image to realize the importance and the significance of that experience. And to be able to show that to another dad and to say to that other dad, visually or as an individual one-on-one, you're not alone in that struggle. And it's okay to recognize that in a moment you can be not the best parent in the world, but you can try to make a difference. You can change this. The parents don't get enough recognition. They're not part of that national conversation. The national conversation is very much about the individuals who are affected. But it doesn't talk about the support network, what I refer to as the ripple effect of autism. And they're very much part of this story, and I really felt strongly that they should not be ignored. They should be supported and represented.
So with your daughter, it was a look of defiance. Yeah. What about with the other children?
Sometimes it's about fear. Sometimes it's about play and flirtation. There's a portrait of Magnus the Magnificent, this wonderful, beautiful little boy who, in reality, could not look you in the eye. When I first met Magnus and his parents, he was hiding behind his mom. And any time I would look at Magnus, he would hide. He would literally either run behind mom or hide his face. My son was running around the set, and so Magnus got kind of interested and ran over there. And the next thing, and I'm talking to the parents, next thing I know, out of the corner of my eye, I see Magnus is sitting on the posing stool looking at me. And I looked at him, and he shyly looked away. And I sort of sidestepped over and picked up the camera, and he's looking at me still, and I'm not looking at him. And I look through the camera, and Magnus could look at me eye to eye as long as the camera was pointed at him. But anytime I looked up over the top of that camera, he would look away. And so this beautiful little play starts to happen where this shy little boy with his hands over his face reveals the child mom knew was there. And so Magnus and I got to make a gift that we could give back, that his mom knew was in existence, that the rest of the world never has had the opportunity to see.
Your work has been exhibited in multiple museums.
Yeah.
Could you talk about what you hope will happen as more people see this work?
I want people to see the struggle of autism, the real people of autism, the beauty of autism, It's not an easy answer. It's not a glamorous answer. I don't want people to think everything is fine. It's not fine, but it's not a death sentence. I remember the first time that anybody ever used the term autism with my child and the terrifying sense of a death sentence that I thought. It's not that. It's extremely complicated. Daily life with autism is not easy. As much as people will say, you know, how my wife and I are such incredible parents, they don't see what goes on behind closed doors. They don't see the fights and the rage experiences and the struggles with transitions and the dietary issues and the health issues. And we have high-functioning kids. Those individuals and families who are not high-functioning, there's a very different story there. We cannot let them fall between the cracks. We cannot let them become invisible in our society. And so my work is not about awareness. Our society is aware of autism. It's really a call to action for people to do something, to no longer ask me the question, well, what can I do? But to make a decision to do something, to reach out to your politicians, to demand that they try to make some good out of this, to demand that insurance stands up and does exactly what we pay them to do, take care of people who are suffering on a daily basis, to go into your public schools, to demand that your principals and your public institutions are setting themselves up to handle this avalanche that's coming at them. It's going to crush the education system. Every child will suffer from this, not just those who are on spectrum, but every neurotypical child too, because the teachers can't handle this thing that's going to be coming at them. We're not prepared in the university. We get individuals on a daily basis who have sensory issues, who are on the spectrum. They're clearly high functioning, but we as teachers, we as an institution, aren't set up to handle them yet. We've got to change the way we think. And this is what I'm saying when I say a call to action. Do something now. Stop delaying.
Have you seen any of these changes happen, especially in Utah, where we have the highest rate of autism?
I see a tremendous willingness on individuals' parts. I'm not sure that I see it in the institutions themselves. I would love to see that change. It's going to take huge reform. And one area that I do see a significant amount of push in Utah of an institution, an organization who's trying to make a difference, is actually in the churches. And the great, you know, push for this is actually coming out of the LDS Church. They're using their organizational power to get their community to come together and look at how not only they can help folks who are in their own community, but how they can reach out to the larger religious communities to work together to support what government cannot, will not take care of. And they're having a really interesting and I think a very successful result out of that. Now, the rest of society, I think, has to start to look at that and has to recognize that model. I see changes in our society literally in the grocery store. You know, when I started this journey, I would see my own children would have meltdowns in the store, or I would see other families struggling with children who were really having a really difficult sensory time in the grocery store. And you'd look around and you would see people sort of scowling and scoffing, or they would make just horrible jabby comments. And in time, I realized we have to change those people first. And so I started walking up to them just very gently and kind of lean over and go, you know, I think maybe that child has autism. And it's interesting what social pressure does and how it makes people stop and think. We're dealing with a community that I think we're in a reform position. We have the opportunity to kind of stand on our heads and say, we won't take it anymore. You have to treat us with respect.
How old are your own children now, and how are they doing?
Maddie tomorrow turns 7. It's her wonderful 7th birthday. Caleb is 5 and a half. So we've been on this journey a little while now.
Do you see a better future for them than people who might have been diagnosed 10 years ago? Do you see people being more accepting and them being in jobs where they can thrive?
It's very hard to think that far in the future for them. Yes, I think socially we are more sensitive than we used to be. I'm hopeful that society will reform itself and my kids will have opportunities that others have not had. The change in our society in 10 years has been pretty significant. The change in our society since I was a kid has been pretty significant. I guess where I hedge is, I think no matter what, individuals who are on the spectrum who have social challenges and are very high functioning are often going to be institutionally abused. And I would love to see that change. Bullying is a massive problem for this community. And bullying manifests in lots of ways. It's not just physical. It's social. It's emotional. It happens from employers. It happens from coworkers. You know, if you work with an Asperger's individual, they're not the easiest person in the world to work with. They're brilliant. They're spectacular. They can be tremendously giving and caring. They're a little rough around the edges. And you have to love that roughness. You know, and what you'll get is incredible results, incredible value, amazing individuals to be in relationship with. But I guess I have a negative sense that humanity isn't ready for it. You know, it's going to take a tremendous amount of courage on the rest of society to look at, you know, these folks and say, wow, you're awesome. You're kind of quirky, but you're awesome. You know, and smile at them and pat them on the back and be close friends with them instead of, you know, scowling at them and thinking, wow, you're driving me crazy, and having no patience for them. That's just not acceptable anymore.
Are you still taking more photographs or where is this
going
now?
Oh, I don't see this project ending for a very long time. The goal is thousands of portraits. It will take me 10 years, if not the rest of my life, to continue this project. As long as autism is not fully recognized, I feel like I have to do this. This community deserves this kind of representative voice for them. And it's not about me. It's very much about this community. And I feel really honored to be able to have the opportunity to be in relationship with every individual that I've had the opportunity to photograph and to work with and to get to know. They've all been such incredible people, every single one of them. The work is not about just individuals on the spectrum, but it's also that ripple effect. There are parents in there. There are researchers. There are clinicians. There are teachers and therapists. There are adults who are on the spectrum. And I like the fact that what I'm doing in the photograph is you can't tell who has autism and who doesn't, because autism can often be an invisible disorder. In fact, in Utah, we're really lucky this year because in the middle of August, the U.S. Autism and Asperger's Association will be having their annual conference, their national conference, in Salt Lake City. It's a great organization where people can learn about everything from behavioral options to biomedical interventions, you know, to relationship development. They can meet individuals who are on the spectrum, who are advocates. These are incredible ways to get informed about a community that if you don't understand what autism is, you can really learn.
To see Christopher Gauthier's art and learn more about evidence and artifacts facing autism, visit ChristopherGauthier.com. You can also find the link on our Facebook page at SQ Radio.
Thank you for tuning in. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science. Programming is also made possible in part by USU Human Resources.
Waste not. Install a rain sensor on your irrigation controller so your system won't run when it's raining. Also, install water-wise fixtures and appliances.
Waste Not is made possible by the Logan City Public Works Water Conservation Department. Information at loganutah.org/publicworks.
This is Utah Public Radio. KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Thank you for tuning in to Science Questions. You can check out this broadcast or any of our other broadcasts online at upr.org. That's upr.org.